Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
And I'm Robert Krulwich.
And today on Radiolab, we're looking at memory and...
forgetting.
Right, forgetting. And we're looking at how these two processes, remembering and forgetting, are intertwined. And writer Andre Codrescu has an idea about this.
The other day, a friend of mine was explaining how she had to move these pixels around her computer and had to add 20 megabytes of memory to handle the operation. I had the disquieting thought that all this memory she was adding had to come from somewhere. Maybe it was coming from me because I couldn't remember a thing that day. And then it became blindingly obvious. All the memory that everybody keeps adding to their computers comes from people. Nobody can remember a damn thing. Every time somebody adds memory to their machine, thousands of people forget everything they knew. Americans are singularly devoid of memory these days. We don't remember where we came from, who raised us, when our wars used to be, what happened last year, last month, or even last week. School children remember practically nothing. I take the Greyhound bus every week, and I swear half the people on there don't know where they got on or where they're supposed to get off. The explanation is simple. Computer companies are stealing human memory to stuff their hard drives. Greyhound, I believe, has some kind of contract with IBM to steal the memory of everyone riding the bus. They are probably connected by a cable or something. Every 100 miles, poof! Another 500 megabytes gets sucked out of the passengers' brains. The computer's thirst for memory is bottomless. The more they suck, the more they need. Eventually, we'll all be walking around with a glazed look in our eyes, trying to figure out who it is we live with. And then we'll forget our names and addresses, and we'll just be milling around trying to remember them. The only thing visible about us will be these cables sticking out of our behinds, feeding the scraps of our memory to Computer Central somewhere in Oblivion, USA. I think it's time for all these memory-sucking companies to start some kind of system to feed and shelter us when we forget how to eat, walk, and sleep.
Andre Codrescu with an essay from the book 101 Damnations. And he actually has a new book of short essays about New Orleans called New Orleans, Mon Amour. Anyways, Robert.
Yes.
Mon Amour. Andre's he's trying to make a point about, you know, historical amnesia in America and whatever. But what if we were to take what he's saying literally, like we were to, and explore it? Like, we know you can subtract a memory. We did that earlier. But what if you could add a memory? Like, actually add a memory in back into a brain that wasn't there
before. What do you mean by add memory?
Well, implant a false memory.
Ooh.
Count back. Okay, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. My name is Elizabeth Loftus. I'm on the faculty at the University of California, Irvine.
Depending on who you talk to, Elizabeth Loftus is either a hero or Dr. Evil. Her research, which goes back more than two decades, has completely changed how we think about memory.
Well, for many...
I spoke with her recently about it.
For many years, I and other psychologists were doing experiments in which we distorted the memories of events that people had actually experienced. So we would take somebody who'd seen a simulated auto accident or a simulated crime, and we would alter the details in their memory report. We'd make people believe that they saw a car go through a stop sign instead of a yield sign. And we found it was not that hard to alter people's memories of these previously experienced events. But more recently, we've gone even further and shown that you can plant entirely false memories into the minds of people. Memories for things that didn't happen.
Like what?
Well, we planted a memory that when you were about 5 or 6 years old, you were lost for an extended period of time in a shopping mall.
What's your job?
You were frightened, you were crying, and ultimately you were rescued.
Are you lost?
By an elderly person.
We find your mother.
And reunited with the family.
And how did you implant that memory?
We told them that we had talked to their parents and that we'd learned some things that happened to them when they were a child.
They basically interview the subjects about their past.
Yeah.
They'd say, hey, do you remember that time when you were on the bike and you fell?
Which they were making up.
No. They would start with a true story. They'd start with true story. And then they'd say, hey, do you remember that time, which was true? Remember that other time, which was true? And that other time, which was true? And somewhere in the middle of all of those true stories, they would slip in the lie.
The false made-up story about being lost and frightened and crying. And in that particular study, we found that about a quarter of our subjects fell sway to the suggestion and they adopted it as their own memory.
A quarter of her subjects, when she checked with them later, now had in their head a memory of being lost and then found in the mall that never happened.
I would have been the number one guy in that quarter.
What is happening in this situation is people take their image of an actual shopping center, actual family members, really? And they construct an experience out of these bits and pieces. Investigators in this field have made people believe that they had accidents at family weddings or that they were a victim of a vicious animal attack or that they nearly drowned and had to be rescued by a lifeguard. Even with these pretty traumatic ideas, you can make people believe that it happened to them.
Actually, we had this very same experience. When I was in law school, we had this professor. He was a professor of property, and he was doing a lecture. And in the middle of the lecture, and this was not, in any way, we were not prepared for this.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the guy zips into the class, in the very front of the class, grabs something from the professor, and then runs out.
Just stole it?
Stole it. I don't even remember what it was, but it happened so suddenly.
Uh-huh.
And Professor Berger said, oh, my God. I said, did any of you see the curly-haired guy? He just went and he just sort of threw it in.
Mm.
The curly-haired guy. But it turned out that what he called the curly-haired guy, when the man came back later to present himself, was not a curly-haired guy at all. He was a straight-haired guy.
So the whole thing was staged.
Yeah, we were all eyewitnesses, and we all had been coached inadvertently to see something that wasn't true. And we all saw it.
What I find interesting is why that kind of suggestion works so well on memory. And Kareem Nader, the guy we heard from earlier, scientist, he puts it this way. Suppose you witness a crime and the police ask you some questions later and they say, did you see a red Camaro leave the scene?
And you're thinking about going, yeah, not, no red Camaro.
No, didn't see one. But then maybe the policeman asks you again, are you sure you didn't see one? And suddenly you're like, well,
I think, well, maybe there was. Maybe I forgot.
You start to question it because, as he puts it, when you are remembering something, the memory is unstable.
Memory comes back up to this unstable state.
It's being rebuilt, recreated. And in that moment, someone, without even meaning to, can slide something new in.
And so as the memory gets, restored with the image of the red Camaro, the next day when the judge asks you, was there a red Camaro there? From your perspective, it's a real memory.
Yeah, but what's so fascinating to me about that phenomenon, assuming it's true,
yeah,
is that the red Camaro that is now in your head,
yeah,
is a vivid Technicolor red,
yeah,
Camaro. You can see the light bounce off the hood. It just feels,
yeah,
real. You can taste the air.
It's amazing how detailed these things can be.
Which is why when someone contradicts your memory, says it didn't happen that way, you're like, yeah, it did. Screw you.
Well, it feels like a robbery.
Right.
They're taking it from you.
And in fact, this got Elizabeth Loftus in a lot of trouble. Back in the mid-80s, there were a lot of people, I don't know if you remember this, coming forward with repressed memories, like, I was abused by a Satanistic cult and performed rituals and whatever, all that stuff.
Oh, right. I remember that.
We now know a lot of those memories were imagined. And she says, at the time, she was one of the only people to raise her hand and say, excuse me. And it got her in a lot of trouble.
I've never really seen anything like the wrath of hostility. When I began to write articles and publish on this subject, again, it was pretty amazing, the vitriol.
What kind of things would they do or say?
Oh, that, my life was threatened. Armed guards would have to be hired at universities where I was being asked to speak. I had the bomb squad at my house on one occasion. One day I was taking an airplane flight, and when the woman sitting in the seat next to me learned who I was, she started to swat me with her newspaper. And and it was kind of hard to extract myself from her because, you know, airplanes are crowded places. You know, the fact of the matter is memory is malleable, and we might as well face the truth.
This isn't to say that you could have a repressed memory and it just might be true. I mean, not all repressed memories are false.
Sure, sure.
And in that regard, this next story you're going to hear, I don't want to tell you much about it. I'll just tell you that it's about a painter.
And it's produced by Neda Perrin.
The first thing you notice in Joe Ando's studio is horses. A big milky one straight ahead, sepia ones to the left and right, staring at you like they don't care about you, but they don't mind you either. They're really like dreams of horses.
I never paint horses that are being manipulated with a bridle or anything. They're mostly just hanging out. It comforts me to have paintings of horses around.
Over the past 10 years, the horses have multiplied, and Joe doesn't even know why he keeps painting them.
I guess it's kind of like, I just kind of tune it in or something, or like you're tuning your guitar, you know, you ding, 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 into, you know, the two strings resonate, you know, and you know it's in tune.
In a Manhattan studio, surrounded by stacks of these animals, you start forgetting you're in Chelsea. Maybe you're in a stable instead. Sometimes even the gesso starts to smell like mulch and hay. When Joe got here in the mid-80s, no galleries were offering solo or group shows, and like all the other hundreds of artists in New York, he was struggling.
I'd been in New York for about 6 years, and nothing was happening. And I was beginning to think nothing was going to happen. And I was, you know, I had a kid, and I was married, and so I stopped painting for a few months, which is a long time for me. And I missed it. So I started painting again for myself. You know, after, you know, the dishes were done, all my domestic chores were fulfilled, I'd sit down at the dining table and paint.
And what showed up on these canvases were pastures. Lush and open. The kind of pastures you'd see on a postcard from somewhere in Wyoming. Or in this case, Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Joe grew up.
Well, I can show you some of my paintings. Me and my buddies, we'd park out here and we'd get high in the evening. Like this is a summer evening, you know?
Joe runs his hand through the air in front of a massive painting leaning against the wall. It's of a field at dusk. It's like he's showing me property.
And we would trip and we would contemplate the universe, you know? Like, what do you think's those stars? What's behind them?
It's one of those fields with thick grass that's matted where people might have laid down.
Yeah.
There are some trees to lean against, separating the grass and the road.
Our high school sat on Route 66, right on the edge of Tulsa. And, you know, you pull out of school at lunchtime and you take a left and you could drive right down Route 66 into the heart of Tulsa. And you could take a right and you could go out to there's farmland. You know, this was in the early 70s and we would, of course, take a right.
So when Joe stopped trying to paint for anyone else, he drifted backwards into his adolescence, all those breezy right turns out of the school parking lot.
And ultimately, this is what people lined up for.
Joe had one show, and then another one, studio visits from private collectors, then calls from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Whitney, even sitcom art directors. All the while, he kept on painting his deserted landscapes. Then, as he describes it,
about 10 years ago, horses started showing up in my repertoire, so to speak.
The pastures weren't empty anymore. They started to draw mares and foals to themselves, some in the far distance, some so close that they're out of focus.
And then, about a year ago, I started painting girls.
Joe's first attempt at the human form. The girls are all on their own canvases. They're undressed, stepping out of a darkened space. Some of them look like they're about to say something.
And I'm just following my gut. I'm painting these pictures, and I don't really know why. You know, and after a few months, I was sitting back, and I was sort of reflecting. I was looking at all these things. And I noticed that they all looked the same. They all looked like the same girl.
Looking over all the paintings in the studio, they clearly are the same girl, but in a dozen different angles. She has the look of a 16-year-old in 1972.
Like my first love kind of thing.
Her name was Kay.
It was like my first soulmate, the first, you know how the first time you feel like you're not alone.
She's beautiful. Oval face, almond eyes that look right into you.
And then I remember this moment with her and me and the horse in the car.
Joe realized he'd been painting a memory, the fragments of one afternoon 30 years earlier, each ingredient emerging slowly.
We were parked in the backseat of my Nova, 67 Nova, in this pasture, and we were in the back seat, and a horse looked in the window. It was just like this moment, it was just like, you know, this horse is there, and she's there, and I was in love. I had a beautiful naked girl there with me in the back seat of my car. You know, it just didn't get any better. I was skipping out of school, so I wouldn't have to speak. I wouldn't have to be in class. I was on Easy Street. I probably had $5 in my pocket, you know. Enough gas to get home. I had some cigarettes. I don't know.
Why did you break up?
I think I cheated on her. I think that's why.
Joe.
I think that's what happened. I went to the lake and I did something I shouldn't have. Right, you know, in front of somebody she knew. She moved away to Minnesota for some reason. And she called me one day. And we went out dancing, and we drank beer and danced, and I took her home to the place she was staying. She was staying with some friends in this old house behind an appliance store, and I dropped her off, and she looked at me like this. Says, aren't you coming in? And I says, no, I have to go see somebody else. I forget her name.
You had a new girlfriend?
New girlfriend. And she lit a cigarette, slammed the door, and she died in a fire that night. I got a call the next morning.
A car door slams. A girl turns and looks over her shoulder at a guy she won't be seducing that night. A fragment of a moment frozen in time.
I mean, and the funny thing is, she was so spirited. If anybody was going to come back and haunt me, she would.
How old were you?
Well, like 21.
How old was she?
She was probably 19.
That day in the car, with his girl and the horse looking in, Joe thinks the memory of that one afternoon in Tulsa might be some sort of post-traumatic pleasure syndrome. An echo that bounced off Jupiter and caught up with him again.
And then again, they're just paintings, too. They're just color, and these are just excuses for me to make another painting.
There's something alluring about Joe Ando's paintings. They draw you in. Maybe that's why people pay big money for them. But the only thing that anyone who wasn't there in the field with Joe, Kay, and the horse can do is look. From the outside into an impenetrable past that's finished. That memory, that story, is self-sustaining and whole, looping endlessly in an alternate universe.
That's the reason I don't title these. I don't put, you know, there's no ending, there's no beginning. Just every day and stir it up again.
Joe Ando has a new memoir. It's called Jubilee City, and it is published by William Morrow.
We will continue in a moment.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.